Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. My story starts about 15 years ago when I was a young professor at the MIT Media Lab. And we were trying to build a computer that worked like the human brain. We sort of imagined that we could figure out all the components inside your brain and reproduce them with electronic components. In particular, my colleagues and I wanted to build computers that could see the way we see, that could hear the way we hear, that had perceptual intelligence. And as you heard, I worked a lot on the understanding of video. As we studied how the brain sees and hears, we learned about the cortex, the part of the brain near the scalp that we believed was most critical for human intelligence. But over Christmas break one year, I was reading a book on synesthesia, and I learned that there are people who have heightened perceptual experiences, and their cortex actually was not active during these heightened perceptual experiences. In fact, what was showing more activity were these subcortical regions. And I thought, that's puzzling. What's going on down there? That's the old part of the brain. That didn't seem to be that important for human intelligence. And as I learned more about these quote-unquote limbic regions, I learned that they were the home of emotion, memory, and attention. Now, for perception, I knew that memory and attention were important. But I was a young woman in computer science and engineering, and I did not want to be associated with emotion. Unfortunately, the more I learned about these regions, the more I learned that emotion played a pivotal role in intelligence, not just in perception, but also in decision-making, in language, in action selection, in every kind of artificial intelligence that we were trying to see built around us at MIT and beyond. It looked like emotion played a critical role. And wanting to figure out what was really going on to solve some of the hard problems in AI that didn't seem to be making a lot of headway with the traditional purely cognitive methods, I started digging into it, and I produced a paper called Affective Computing, which was rejected from a journal. And since I was almost up for tenure, I thought, well, okay, I'm never going to get this published in the usual way, so I'll write a book. And I poured out a bit of a manifesto about how we could build computers that have emotional intelligence, that know not just what they're seeing, but what they're seeing that matters, that know not only how to listen to a sound, but how to pick out the sounds that shift your attention, and how to know what bits to remember, the important bits. So as we learned about this, we realized that a lot of technology needed to be developed to help us really understand emotion. Most of emotion was understood with questionnaires by psychologists. And when you read the psychology, it was, as an engineer, I didn't like it. It wasn't very systematic. It was not very precise. It was not objective. It was subjective. And it was not repeatable or reliable. So we set out to build tools that would enable us to get more repeatable and reliable measures of emotional data. The one that people ask about most is reading the face. The face is the part of your emotional communication that is usually most visible at a distance. The smile is most visible at a distance. So we built technologies to track points on the face, look where you're looking, read nods and shakes, and interpret the dynamics of those movements. In particular, this work started with one day a guy came into my office and said, I hear you're building computers that can recognize emotion. I said, well, you know, we're trying to recognize the outward expressions of emotion. And he said, do you know about autism? And I didn't really know anything about autism or autism spectrum disorders. And he started telling me about his brother who had trouble reading people's emotions on their face. So we decided we would build a kind of an affective prosthesis. Sometimes people have they're missing an arm or a leg and they have a physical prosthetic device. We thought we would build an emotional prosthetic device that would enable people who had a hard time reading facial expressions to have an aid to do this. I've got a Google Glass now that is getting closer to being able to do this, but back then it looked a little clunkier, like in this cartoon. And we needed a lot of data, so we went online and got data with an example like this. What you see here, the amplitude is the intensity of smiles of groups of people watching this ad. This became the most popular advertisement in the US this year, a couple years ago. You see the peak smiles of the groups in orange and green are higher than the group in purple. The orange and green groups were people who had seen the ad before, and they're actually smiling more when they see it again. Last night I was practicing some of these slides, and one of the AV gurus backstage said, "Ads in China, they're all boring." That's true of most ads in the US too. But when you see one like this that makes people smile, and then they see it again and they smile even more, and in fact, in this case, they also smile in advance of the joke, then it's a sign of a success for the company. So they can see the audience response and produce content that is more effective and more engaging for us, whether it's an ad or a movie or an online course. Here's another example where higher is more positive and lower is more negative. We're computing much more complicated expressions now. Colors are corresponding to different age groups. Okay, here's where they later said they wished they'd cut the ad, but in fact, for the most expensive Super Bowl, they paid millions of dollars extra to run the second half. Here the responses are much more negative. That's the under 18-year-olds in blue. Now, I show you these because when the executive of Volkswagen saw this, he said he wished he had this data when they were making their decision whether or not to cut the ad in the middle. Internally, they all thought the Vader bar scene was so great and everybody would know that ad, so we have to put that in. But most of the people out there watching it didn't make that connection a year later. So they just thought this was weird and it was kind of negative at the end. So often we think we know what somebody else feels because we think they feel the way we feel. But when the technology lets you give people the chance to opt in and communicate what they really feel, you can sometimes learn that the objective data is different than what you thought it should be. And that's valuable information. So we went online to get a lot of this data to build systems where the machine learning was more accurate. And now we have almost 1 million facial videos and over 1 billion emotionally labeled points, automatically labeled. And the machine learning is now greater than 90% accurate on more than 8 different affective measures. And this is now a product. It's out there running 24/7 in over 56 countries, gathering affective data online, mostly in advertising right now. They were the early payers. But where I really hope to see it go is toward tools that would enable us all to have better nonverbal feedback with online experiences. Now, I mentioned in my talk title that I'm going to talk about some surprises. And one of the surprises in doing this work was that we were all taught that if you smile both with your mouth and with your eyes, it means you're truly delighted. In fact, one of the things I wrote in my book is, this is the true smile of happiness. And that was based on a lot of literature and neurology. But we found when we got a lot of real-world data that that theory was wrong. All the people shown here have their picture taken at a peak affective moment, but they're not all delighted. Let me play you a clip where these come from. And first I'll just ask you, I don't know the Chinese word for this, what is the emotion that technology is most commonly eliciting, especially from people who don't like it? Could tell me in Chinese. The word, in English it's frustration. Here's an example of how we elicited frustration. And this video should play. I may need help from the AV guys. Hey, guys. They're going to make the tech. Oh, back up here. Wait, we got to play this one first. Play this video. And of course, the technology breaks to be frustrating.
I am sorry. You seem to be having difficulties getting through this form. Would you mind looking at the camera and share your thoughts on how to improve the form?
This one sucks.
People sometimes send me articles where people have hit their computer or they've shot their computer or they admit to cursing to their computer. There's a lot of frustration out there. Now, the student here experiencing that looked frustrated. In the next video, they're encountering the same thing, but you're going to watch this and you'll see this student actually smiles when he's very frustrated. And it's the true smile that supposedly means delight. It involves both the lip corner pull, action unit 12, and the cheek raise that gives you the eye crinkles, action unit 6. So watch the context. It's the same as the previous one. Smile. And look at the smile by the eyes. Right here. See? Big, quick smile. Okay, but he's not happy. So at the peak moments, we were surprised to learn that the smile of delight looks just like the smile of frustration. And in fact, when you give people the test of these, they're only about 50%. They're about random at telling which of these were smiles of delight and which were smiles of frustration. We've, for years, been training machine learning algorithms to recognize facial expressions that were collected in laboratories where people acted afraid or sad or happy. And it turns out that's pretty easy to teach a computer to recognize the acted emotions. But to teach a computer to recognize the real emotions, where they really happen, is very hard. And it involves more than just recognizing where the points on the face are. We've recently been working on some more dynamic approaches to not just tracking the points, but interpreting the onset, sustain, and decay of the different affective expressions. And we now have an algorithm that is 92% accurate at detecting the frustrated smiles. It's actually better than humans at detecting when a smile is arising in a frustrating situation. Now, that doesn't mean that all of the facial emotion expression is better than humans. It's still very limited to narrow contexts. We have a lot to learn to associate what's happening on the face with gestures, with context, in order to get this kind of performance in all situations. Let's look now at a system where we're putting this together to give feedback to users.
When people talk to each other, the majority of the information that's conveyed comes from the way we say things rather than the words we're actually saying. Eye contact, smiles, voice modulation, speaking rate, pauses, and emphasis on certain words often add an extra layer of information in our interactions. Many of us want to improve these interaction skills, but don't have the resources to do so. Imagine if you could practice your interaction skills with an automated system in the privacy of your own living room. A program designed at the MIT Media Lab lets you do just that.
Hi, I am Mary. I'm looking forward to doing your interview.
My automated conversation coach consists of a 3D character on a computer screen that can see, hear, and make its own decisions based on its interaction with a person, and it works on a personal computer.
Now, let's get started.
Using a webcam, the system can analyze facial expressions. For example, it can measure where in the interaction you are smiling and can recognize your head gestures, such as a nod or a shake. The system also analyzes your voice. It not only understands what you say, but how you say it. Using real-time speech recognition and prosody analysis, it can capture the nonverbal nuances of conversations and display it in an intuitive format. When you're done, it gives you a summary of the information, when you smiled, how fast you spoke, and so on, and it can show how these measures change over multiple sessions. It even allows you to watch the video of your interactions with various measures of your behavior displayed alongside the video, such as when you smile, how the volume of your voice rises and falls, and what words you emphasize. It even shows when your attention wanders.
I can't find you. Oh, there you are. You were saying...
In a study with 90 MIT undergraduates, the subjects went through simulated job interviews before and after receiving this training. Those who got the feedback from this automated system were rated as better candidates for the job than those who did not. Besides job interviews, the researchers say this system could help with public speaking, dating, learning languages, or helping people who have difficulties in social communications.
So Mach is an example of a system that recognizes some aspects of the nonverbal communication and then presents them back to you in a context where you can use that information to improve your own skills at a situation. And here we were able to discover that it did improve MIT students' ability to be rated highly in an interview. The next challenge, well, or the one we actually wanted to do initially, but it's too unconstrained, is one that people ask us for frequently at MIT and maybe here also, and that's help asking somebody on a date, having a social or a flirtatious type of a dialogue. That turns out to be incredibly hard to understand how to do, both for people and for machines. So there's a real good computer science challenge to figure out how to do that in a natural way and understand when it's working well versus when it's not. We've been particularly interested in helping people who have affective limitations, who have trouble reading and interpreting affective information, not just computers and robots having that problem, but people who do. And in the beginning, we thought that autism was characterized by inability to read somebody else's emotions. Well, it turns out many people with autism can read other people's emotions. Some don't want to read other people's emotions. They don't even want to engage in a face-to-face interaction. And many, to our surprise, because we got to know them as part of an ethic we have when we design something is to get to know the people that we're designing it for and to try to really understand what they want versus just what the technology can do. And as we got to know our users, many of them said what they really need is to be better understood. They said it's not just that sometimes some of them have trouble understanding our emotions, but they said that you know, hey, Roz, you have trouble understanding our emotions. Regular people need to learn to understand us. And they were right. And we started to look at how they communicated their stress and frustration. And in particular, many people on the autism spectrum who don't have language to tell us what's going on, or even if they do, they may be unable to communicate their feelings, they're experiencing a lot of stress. Many of them have hypersensitivities to sounds, to lights, to fluorescent lights, to smells, to things in the environment that some of us don't even notice, but to them, they're ready to just go in the corner and hide from it all. It's so overwhelming. So if we could help their feelings be represented outside of them, then maybe people around them would see what's bothering them and help debug the environment for them. So the first technology that came to mind for this was one we had developed years before for measuring the arousal dimension of emotion. Some of you may have known of what used to be called galvanic skin response. That's kind of a loose collection. That's a label that goes for a variety of different things. More specifically, we measure the electrodermal activity and measure it electrically as skin conductance. It's been studied over 100 years. It's usually measured on the fingers or on the sole of the foot. We built different forms that let us take it out of the lab and measure it in audience environments and in classrooms and on playgrounds. This became a commercial sensor. I'm wearing actually another version we're working on now. And this enabled us for the first time to get the data in the wild, out where emotions were really happening. Here's an example of the data being streamed from the two ankles of a girl with autism. The blue window, the right edge of it, is what you see in the video right now. Higher is more conductive and is more aroused, and we'll see it peak in a moment when she has a meltdown. So a bit of a tantrum there. We also see it go down when she calms down, when she swings, when she engages in repetitive movements, when she gets in a ball pit. For the first time, we were able to read out of her body what was going on with respect to the things in her environment that were causing her escalating stress or that were calming her down. And this gave the occupational therapists the opportunity to see what was reliably and repeatedly able to help regulate her and help her learn also what this felt like and what could give her an enhanced sense of control over her feelings. So we see it going down now as she's relaxing in this ball pit here. With that, people are able to better customize therapies and treatments and understand what's going on with a person. Now, in the examples with this girl, she looked stressed on the outside when the signal said stressed on the inside, and she looks calm on the outside as it's going down. But for many people, that's not the case. We've seen a boy laying on the floor looking like he's relaxed, but inside he's ready to explode. And he might be hitting the floor in order to try to calm himself down. We've also seen a great big guy jumping up and down looking like he's about to explode when in fact his level is so low he might need 20 minutes of jumping up and down just to get up to a normal range. So sometimes what you see on the outside is very different from what we can now measure on the inside. And the objective data lets us get a more accurate observation of what's going on. If you do machine learning and you're familiar with the concept of hidden variables, a lot of our emotional states are like hidden variables, and we are now making them unhidden. We are making them observable, and it's enabling us to better understand people. Now, the signal that we just measured on the skin is a particularly interesting one because the skin is the only organ that is purely innervated by the sympathetic nervous system that we know of. The sympathetic nervous system is one branch of the autonomic nervous system. It's the branch that we think of as the fight or flight response. And that's the one shown on the left here. On the right here is the parasympathetic nervous system. And this we think of as the rest and digest. This is the one that is a little bit dangerous to be up against after lunch. Everybody gets very calm and wants to fall asleep. The best way we know of to measure the sympathetic is with the skin conductance response right now. The best way we know of to measure the parasympathetic right now is with the heart rate variability, and I'll say more about a surprising new way to get that at the end of this talk. This data is the first time that I saw that sympathetic nervous system response as skin conductance measured all day, 24 hours, by 7 days, a whole week. And here the data is from an MIT student, and you'll notice the regions in that there are a lot of peaks on the left, like take the top row, there's a lot of activity for the lab, and it's very low watching TV. There's surprising peaks during sleep, which I'll say more about in a moment. Day six, day five, we see again a lot of activity with studying, and down on day one, huge activity with laboratory and studying. And to the embarrassment of we MIT professors, the lowest activity consistently is the classroom activity over on the right in yellow. I wonder how that compares to the online MOOCs. This data, that was a week of data. This is 3 months of data for five children who have autism. And what you're seeing here is a very simple measure. You're just simply seeing the average value of the skin conductance on the wrist each day for 60 days for each child. And it's a histogram. It's the number of days they have each of the different levels. And what jumps out right away is that two of these children, their levels almost never go above one. You might say they're wired kind of on the low side. Whereas these other two children who have the same autism diagnosis, their average level is above what's effectively the max for the other kids. We've been working also with some kids who are genetically identical twins with the same genetic disorder, and they too sometimes have very different physiology. So the genes alone do not dictate your physiology. We need other measures to start to understand what this is. And this one measure of the arousal dimension of the emotion system turns out to give us important physiological information that communicates with every organ in the body. One of my favorite surprises was when over Christmas break, one of the students in my lab asked if he could borrow one of our sensors. This was back when it was a bunch of hand-soldered wires stuck in a sweatband. And he wanted to take a look at his little brother's stress over the break. His little brother has autism and could not speak, and he thought he could see what was causing him more stress and what was calming him. So I said, sure, you know, take two sensors, take a soldering iron, you're going to have to fix them. I was back in my office at MIT looking at the data, and one day looked fairly normal, and the next day looked fairly normal, and I go to the next day, and my jaw drops. The signal was so high that I thought the sensor was broken. Now, I'm an electrical engineer by training, so I thought, okay, maybe, you know, I know what kinds of errors can happen. I'm zooming in on the data. But the data looked fine. It was just huge. In fact, it was perfectly normal right before and after this gargantuan event. I finally called the student at home, said, hi, sorry to call you on vacation. Hey, any idea what happened to your little brother on December 26th at 4 o'clock? And he said, I don't know. I'll check the diary. I thought, oh, MIT student, he keeps a diary, very good. you know, kind of praying, God, what are the odds he wrote down this particular day, this particular hour? He comes back and he says, what time? I said, 4 o'clock. And he looks it up and he goes, that was right before he had a grand mal seizure. Now, I didn't know anything about seizures. I'm an engineer, I study emotion and the brain and computers. So I started looking this up, and I find a local doctor who's an expert on seizures. I call him up. Dr. Madsen, my name is Rosalind Picard. Is it possible that somebody could have a huge sympathetic nervous system surge before a seizure? And he said, Well, maybe before you see the seizure on the outside, but probably not before it actually happens inside the brain. Well, we got IRB approval to do a study in the hospital. We enrolled 90 children, and we found that when we looked at their skin conductance, which you see here on the top graph, the electrodermal activity, and below that you see the accelerometer movement with three spikes here where there's particularly large events. These are grand mal seizures marked in red, and we found that 100% of the grand mal seizures could be detected by an algorithm we built that combined the skin conductance with the accelerometer activity with high reliability, 94% accurate. But we also found something else very surprising. Oh, and I should point out too, those peaks in the middle, those are sleep peaks. Again, these kind of bizarre high peaks during sleep that I'll say a little bit more about in a moment. So we found we could take these two pieces of information, this huge emotional arousal signal and this activity signal, and build a seizure detector. But we also found something else very surprising. But first, I want to show you what a seizure looks like. Now, what do they say? They say if it's 5 minutes, you call for help. But who's necessarily there timing it? And what is the height of that signal we're measuring related to? Was it related to how much movement there was, or to the length of the seizure? Well, it turned out it wasn't related to the amount of movement, and it wasn't related to the length of the seizure. But it was related to something else that turns out to be very important and interesting. And that is, here in this vertical graph is the EEG traces of several electrodes on the scalp. And they're going kind of crazy during the seizure. And then as the seizure, after the seizure ends, instead of going back to normal brain waves, they're going flat. Now that's not good. In fact, in 7 out of 8 cases where a patient died shortly after a seizure, this was observed, this brainwave flattening. We found that the signal on the wrist is highly correlated with how long these brain waves are flattened after the seizure supposedly has ended. This winds up being a signal that usually you have to have an EEG to get, but we're able to get a strong correlate of it now using just a wristband. And this has now appeared in the top neurology medical journal. Now, this is very surprising to find a signal, you know, a brain signal showing up on the wrist, right? Especially an emotion signal. This is kind of bizarre. And as I was scratching my head over this, talking to a group of doctors, one of them said, "Oh, Roz, it's easy. Medicine 101. Remember when you had medicine 101? I didn't want to tell her I never had medicine 101. I just had engineering. Medicine 101, doctors were taught that as an embryo, we have three kinds of tissue. And the first is the ectoderm. And from the moment we were formed and these three kinds of tissue differentiated, one of them has combined the skin with the neural tissue, including these deep brain structures. So the fact that these structures deep in the brain are mapping onto the skin is not so surprising after all. We're also finding other surprises that we can pick now that usually require an EEG. Usually the best way to predict if you learn something well, if you have good memory consolidation, when you learn a task before sleep and are tested on it when you wake up after sleep, is to look at the percent of non-REM, or specifically of slow-wave sleep, early in the evening, and the percent of REM, rapid eye movement, in the morning. And the product of those is, according to Stick Gold and other researchers, one of the best indicators of whether or not a person shows good performance on the learning task versus bad performance. Well, we found that these peaks that were happening during sleep are exhibiting great high frequencies and great regularity, especially early in the night. And it turns out that most of them are happening during slow wave sleep. And they tend to follow some very characteristic patterns that we've now found in typical populations. And we've found some atypical patterns in some atypical and developmentally disabled populations, which is looking interesting too. And then recently, we found that when we ran machine learning, six different methods, on the wrist features, these emotional arousal features that correspond to this high-frequency peaking during non-REM, and we compared its ability to predict the best learners from the worst learners after a night's sleep, that it was significantly more accurate than using the EEG-based methods. It was also significantly more accurate than using the actigraphy, the movement, that is used a lot in the Fuel Bands and Fitbits and iPhones and so forth. So the accelerometer-based methods are also not as accurate. And in fact, when we gave the machine learning algorithm all the features to choose from, the ones that performed the most well, the most predictive, were, again, the skin conductance features, which, again, was a surprise. We would never have predicted that going into this work. And yet, there's something in that emotional signal that seems to be laying down a substrate that may not just be important for emotion, but also for memory and attention. Here's another surprise. I go back to the diagram I put up of the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. We've been trying to find a way to get the parasympathetic information without having to put electrodes on a person. Usually, to get that data, you have to put on an ECG. And sticky electrodes may be fine to wear for an hour or two, but if you want to wear it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, your skin gets gross under the electrodes, and I don't like that. So we're trying to find non-contact ways to measure heart rate. And here in the lower right is Mingzer Po, in the middle is Dan McDuff. These are my co-inventors on a new algorithm for reading your heart rate using only an ordinary webcam. It turns out the principle of, if you've ever had your heart rate taken with one of those finger cuffs, and it's shining the infrared and red light in, it shines in a straight line, your heart, your pulse modulates it, and you read off the peaks to get the heartbeat from that. Turns out the color changes in your face also carry that information. We just don't usually see them. White light bouncing off of your skin is a mix of several colors of light, and if we decompose it appropriately, we can pull out that beating. And here what you see in red is the use of an independent component analysis algorithm to pull out the heart rate, versus in black, the use of a medical quality finger pulse monitor to pull out the heart rate. And it's able to read as many faces as you can track and read each of their heart rates. The way it works is by taking the white light, it's decomposed by the webcam into red, green, and blue. Then we perform the independent component analysis to find three maximally independent channels, one of which contains this periodic heartbeat signal. We also do some additional processing that I can tell you about in a moment. But first, we benchmarked the heart rate information from the face with no contact and a regular low-cost webcam to the expensive finger pulse monitor. Well, hundreds of dollars versus software. And it was 95% correlated on 372 pairs of readings using both sensors simultaneously. And that's over a range of different heart rates and different ages. It also works fine with different color skin. We also want to get the parasympathetic information from this. And it turns out that with If you can observe the person for a minute or two, as opposed to just, you know, 20 to 30 seconds, get a good enough time series under reasonable illumination conditions, you can also get very highly accurate respiration information and beat-to-beat variability information, which, again, doing frequency analysis of that, we're able to pull out some high-frequency data and get at the parasympathetic estimate. So back to your autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic is the fight or flight. It's like stepping on the gas, revving up the engine. And the parasympathetic is the rest and digest. It's like stepping on the brake, slowing you down. So we use the skin conductance to read the sympathetic, and we use this heart rate variability, high frequency, to read the parasympathetic. Here's a beautiful example of this that Mingzer Po did, putting the technology behind a half-silvered mirror. So when you look in the mirror, it's reading your heart rate. It's tracking your face and pulling out these color changes and reporting your heart rate to you. And you can see the medical quality finger pulse is telling him his heart rate's about 76. The mirror is telling him it's about 78. They're both within plus or minus about 4 beats per minute. If you have an iPhone, you can now download an app from Cardio, a company started by Ming, that allows you to read this using this technique on your phone right now. So this was another surprise, is that today you can go from something you didn't even think was possible to not only a peer-reviewed journal paper, but an app for a smartphone in the market, all in about a year's time. It's kind of scary how fast a crazy idea can move to not just to publication, but to a product. All right, this is my last example I'd like to close with. And this is, again, the skin conductance data. So the amplitude of this is how aroused the wearer of the sensor was. This graph goes with a young woman who has autism, and she was speaking. She, in fact, was giving a speech this night, a 3-minute talk, and she was stressed about her speech. And she asked me if she could borrow one of my sensors to wear before the talk because she wanted to see what her stress looked like. I said, sure. Now, many people on the autism spectrum like there to be a schedule, and they like people to stick to the schedule. And this event was supposed to start at 8 o'clock, and a little bit before 8, they announced that it was going to be delayed, and it wouldn't start until about 8:30. Now, this young woman was stressed by this, and her first reaction was to start pacing back and forth. Her male friend, who was sitting nearby, did not like the pacing, and he said, "Stop pacing. That doesn't help." So she stops pacing, and she starts stimming. I asked her what stimming was, and she said it was a kind of a flapping and rocking movement that she did to deal with the stress. Now, what you see here is what is the episode of the pacing, the green, where it's going down, and the stimming, where it's going up. Then the event starts. She gives her 3-minute talk, which is the biggest peak, and then it's mostly downhill from there, punctuated by some surprising peaks that were audio microphone squelching sounds, very stressful. Afterwards, she and her friend and I look at the data, and the first words spoken are from him. He says, "I'm not going to tell you to stop pacing anymore." The next morning, I saw the two of them before another event, and this time she was pacing, and he was just sitting there calmly typing and letting her pace. Sometimes we know that there's a good way to regulate our emotions, but people around us don't believe us, or people don't understand what's going on. When you take something that used to just be subjective, and you make it into data that is now objective, able to be measured and modeled and computationally understood, then we can move from people guessing what's helpful to actually beginning to understand what's helpful. In closing, I've talked a little bit about affective computing, how initially I wanted to stay away from emotion, and I wound up kind of pretty focused on emotion. In affective computing, it's not about making computers emotional. It's really about restoring a balance to computing. Computing has so often completely ignored people's emotion or just tried to make it into something cognitive, which is inadequate. What is needed is a balance. Not too much emotion, not too little emotion, but the right amount of emotional intelligence where we show respect for what people feel and show respect for that in every interaction that we design so that we create experiences that really honor who we all are as human beings. Let me close by putting up some links where I invite you to go and download papers and get more information. Thank you.